Coming up next on the Witness the World podcast, the human brain. We use it or we lose it.
So you're either using your brain and therefore it's getting stronger, or using different abilities and they get stronger, or you stop using them and they get worse. And that's why we're having this problem, because we're giving up a lot of our tasks to the phone rather than actually using our own brain to do a lot of those things, which is really bad for innovation and creativity and collaboration and these things. But also things like attention are decreasing, and we know attention's decreasing because we can study that quite easily, and that is based on how long we're actually looking at things. And because the videos and all these things are getting shorter and shorter, we're actually not able to attend for as long to things, because we're not attending to anything for very long.
The content here is for informational and entertainment purposes only. Any content here should not be construed as financial, medical, or any other type of professional advice. Good day, everyone. Welcome to episode 20 of the Witness the World podcast. My name is Ben Choi, and today we'll be heading to Australia. Our guest is a neuroscientist, an international speaker, and an author. He's on a mission to help us better understand and optimize our most important asset, our brain. Today, we'll learn about his personal journey and hear about some of his most notable findings over the years. We'll also explore some tips and ideas on how to keep our brains sharp, active, and recharge through the different stages of our lives. Dr. Mark Williams, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me along, Ben. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you here. So Mark, from what I've read about you, academics wasn't exactly your thing growing up, but somehow in your mid-20s, something shifted. So just wondering if you could provide a brief overview to our audience to tell us a little bit about your journey and how you've, you know, found yourself in the field of neuroscience today.
Yeah, it wasn't the traditional road to academia. I grew up in a small country town in Australia. There was great, huge unemployment at the time, so it was pretty rough. My mother had mental illness and she self-medicated, which wasn't great. And I didn't really see myself as being academic at all. I was one of those kids that teachers didn't like to have in their classes. I was a truant for most of the time. Back then, we used to get corporal punishment in school, so you get a strap or a cane if you did anything wrong. And so, yeah, to avoid that, me and my friends used to go fishing down the lake and smoking pot. When I was about 16, the principal of the high school told me that I'd be in prison or dead by the time I was 25, so I should go and get an apprenticeship at the local abattoir. So, yeah, I didn't really have any belief in myself and where I was going. It was ironically, when I was 25, I actually returned to school. Two of my friends had drug overdoses, and that really shocked me at the time and shocked me into, yeah, wanting to change things. So I went back to school, and I was lucky enough to meet a physics teacher who saw something in me that I hadn't seen before. He convinced me that I should go to university and do science. And I didn't realize I'd actually really was interested in science until I talked to him, and then I went to university, did a double degree in psychology and physiology. I think I chose psychology, now reflecting back, because I wanted to understand more about my family and why I was so messed up and why the family, you know, was the way it was, which is never a good thing. I don't recommend that people actually do psychology for that reason, but it's amazing how many people do psychology for that reason. And so, yeah, I did that double degree, and then I did a PhD in medical faculty in neuropsychology, which was really interesting because it sort of combined those two interests in the body and in the mind. And went on to work at Melbourne University, and then I was lucky enough to get a fellowship to work at MIT University in the US, which is an amazing place to work. And I worked with amazing people over there for a number of years and then came back to Australia. So yeah, it was a bit of a different route to get into academia, but I'm really glad I did, and I loved, studying the brain, and studying especially human brains, because we're so complex, and it's so adaptive that and we're learning so much. There's so many neuromyths out there based on, old research. And in the last 20 years, 25 years, it's been a huge change in our understanding of the brain, which is really, really cool. And that's why I now work with organizations and schools about, getting that new information out there so that we can all benefit from what we now know, rather than, relying on that old information, which is actually wrong.
Well, that's a great origin stories there, Mark. So, it's funny. I think you've been pondering, the electronics, the impact on people, and then, I ran across your profile, and yeah, it was. I thought you'd be perfect in our little discussion today, and electronics. That's the first thing I want to ask you about. So, from your studies, like, what is the impact of electronics? I mean, I know you've done extensive research. You've got this company who's called Rethinking the Brain, and you wrote, some interesting articles. Like, one was called "Smartphones Are Making Us Dumb." So that really caught my attention. So, gotta ask you, like, what are your main takeaways from your research, and how dumb are those smartphones making us?
it is a big issue, and it's not the devices themselves, it's how we use the devices and how tech companies set up the devices to manipulate us. So what's happening is we're using those devices way more than we need to, and we're using them in a poor way. I mean, since we've had the devices in the last 10, 15 years, we've had a huge increase in mental health issues, depression, anxiety, suicide. And we're getting less intelligent. For the first time in our history, our intelligence level over is actually getting lower rather than higher, which is a real, real concern. We're also, our attentional span has decreased for the first time in history, and our working memory is also decreasing, which is, we never thought that could actually happen, but it actually is happening. And so we need to have a rethink about what the way we're using the devices. And as I said, it's not the devices themselves, but rather the algorithms and the way that they actually use them to manipulate us. I mean, a really simple thing: if you turn off all your notifications, you'll increase or improve your mental health within about 2 weeks, because they're actually using those notifications to cue us constantly to the phone, which is simply a way of creating a habit or an addiction to the phone, or to the, your email, or to social media. And so by turning that off, by not allowing them to do that, you actually get back your time, and you get back your mental health, which is, vitally important. Another simple thing is, if organizations simply don't email their employees and have a ban on emails after hours. So when employees get home, and at the end of the day, they can have a break from work because emails aren't being sent to them. Again, you increase productivity, you increase mental health, improve mental health, and employees are more likely to stay with the organization because they're not feeling stressed all the time. They actually have a break during those nighttime periods. And there's several countries in Europe now that are actually banning companies and fine companies if they actually email their employees after work, because we know that by giving people that break, you allow them to reset, so that the next morning when they come to work, they're more productive and they actually get stuff done. In a lot of countries, we're way busier than we've ever been, but we're less productive than we've ever been. So productivity over the last 15 years has gone down, which is crazy, because we've now got these devices that could improve productivity. But again, the way they've been set up and the way that we're using them is actually decreasing productivity. So we need to have a rethink, and we need to do things differently to the way we're actually doing them. And we need to get control over the way tech companies are setting them up, because the way they set them up is about them making a profit, not us performing better, and them making a profit rather than our mental health. And so, yeah, we need to change that, and we need to improve it. And it's pretty simple ways, right? Getting rid of your notifications, banning the algorithms that they use to manipulate us would be, two really easy things that we could do to actually improve mental health, and improve everybody's lives.
Interesting stuff there, Mark. So it sounds like there's two pieces there. So we could look at, the algorithm side of things, but then also personal accountability. Okay, what can we control? And we have the power to turn it off. There is an off button. So I guess I wanted to touch on, you said one thing about, like the videos and that kind of thing. One observation that I had over the years is, the video length, the duration of the videos, it's kind of become catered shorter and shorter formats. So obviously this podcast, we do the full length podcast. We also do short videos. We try to cater to everybody. However, if someone's just consuming content, like shorter and shorter video length, what I've kind of noticed, with people in general is like, if you watch shorter and shorter stuff, maybe you have shorter and shorter attention span. You're not as patient anymore. I'm just wondering, through your research, have you found any kind of correlation between the two? Is that actually a thing?
No, it's a beautiful, beautiful question. And we know our brains are plastic, so we know our brains are constantly changing and adapting to our environment, whatever that environment happens to be. And we know that our brains change throughout our lives, and it's a use it or lose it. So you're either using your brain and therefore it's getting stronger, or using different abilities and they get stronger, or you stop using them and they get worse. And that's why we're having this problem, because we're giving up a lot of our tasks to the phone rather than actually using our own brain to do a lot of those things, which is really bad for innovation and creativity and collaboration and these things. But also things like attention are decreasing, and we know tension's decreasing because we can study that quite easily. And that is based on how long we're actually looking at things. And because the videos and all these things are getting shorter and shorter, we're actually not able to attend for as long to things because we're not attending to anything for very long. And our attention is constantly being grabbed by things. So, a lot of people have notifications on their email, on their laptop, as well as having social media notifications and all these things. And each time one of those things beeps, your attention gets shifted to that thing. And so each time that happens, you're using your attention for less amount of time. And so, therefore, that ability is getting less and less able to do those things, to actually attend to things for longer. And so, yeah, but people are less likely to watch videos and those sorts of things for as long as they used to. I was told by someone recently, because I like to talk, and they were saying that, I only want you to talk for less than 2 minutes, because all of our research has shown that, anything more than 2 minutes and people will start turning off, which is just nuts. Whereas 20 years ago, people would listen to answers for up to 10 to 15 minutes, whereas they don't now. They only listen for 2 minutes. So yeah, our attention span is getting shorter, and our attention span is what we is necessary. I mean, your attention is what drives the information into your working memory, so that it can be held there for long enough, so it can be transferred to this temporary store and then transferred to your long-term memory, so you actually remember that information. And if your attention isn't maintained for long enough, it won't be transferred to that long-term store. Or if your attention gets caught by something, such as a notification, then it actually deletes everything in your working memory. So our working memory, every time our attention shifts, is being wiped, and we lose the last 90 seconds of what we were doing. So every time you get a beep on your phone, or every time your email little thing icon comes up, or every time you get a social media notification or anything like that, or Teams or any of those things, you lose the last 90 seconds of what you were doing. So imagine how many times you're losing 90 seconds of your thought processes, your thinking time each day. It's a huge amount of time we're all losing every day, which is why we're so busy these days, but we're less productive these days, because we're losing all of that, and we're losing the ability to do that. So we need to be spending more time actually attending to things. And we know children, the younger a child is given a device, or the younger a child is allowed to use a device, the more likely they are to have ADHD. Or I have to have ADHD-like symptoms. And that's, of course, an attentional disorder, because of the fact that they never learn how to actually control their attention, and they never develop that ability. So yeah, it is a huge problem, and it's a huge problem in society. And the more you are flipping from one thing to another, the more you won't be able to actually attend to something for a long period of time.
Interesting thoughts there, Mark. So I guess I was on to something there. So you talk about kids. Okay, so this is what I want to talk about next here. So you're talking about like kids or attention span, and like in my mind, this is another observation. So if the kids, In their formative years, some people say it's like the first, 5 years. Like it's so important to, set the foundation right, have them have structure. And, I know parents, family, friends, relatives, sometimes they give the, electronic device to distract the kids for various things. Sometimes it's, used in a good way to, distract them while they're brushing their teeth because they don't like, babies don't like being have their teeth brushed and different things like that. So in like positive way, that's, can use electronics. But from what your research, like, have you seen where, too much electronics, like, how much is too much electronics for, let's say kids, like babies, was it get to like, under five and then to teenagers? And then, just for you and I, as adults here, like, is there like a formula? Is there some kind of guideline? Just wondering, yeah, what have you seen in through your research?
The biggest problem is we don't really know. We know there's damage being caused. We don't know how detrimental that is, and we don't really have good data on like what age we should be allowing these things. We know that the younger a kid is given a device, the more likely they are to have ADHD. So, or and or autism as well. So you want to avoid as much as possible. We also know that children who learn how to read or spend a lot of time on devices in the first up until primary school, if they're on devices, that you can actually have abnormal development of their white matter tract. So part of their brain actually is abnormally developing if they're actually on a device. So you really want to avoid the devices for the first 5 years of life, because we know that there's actually that abnormal development going on. We don't know why that is happening, but we do know it's going on. There's a big National Institute of Health, NIH, have a huge st ongoing study around that, because there's been several studies showing that, and they're very concerned about what's going to happen in the future because of this abnormal development of those areas of the brain in these kids. But it really is, we're doing this social experiment, this huge worldwide experiment on these kids, and we really have no idea what the outcomes are going to be. We know that it's detrimental, and we know that there's really bad impacts on their brain development, as well as their ability to do certain things, as well as their intelligence levels. But we don't know how bad that's going to be. So, yeah, I say avoid it definitely up until 5 years of age, and then after that, limit it as much as possible, because it's not going to be, good in the future.
Thanks for those insights there, Mark. So yeah, just limit it as much as you can, and I guess introduce it as they get older. And I guess that's kind of where I'm going to go next. As we get older, teenagers, hey, I was one of those that play a lot of video games. I grew out of that phase and, onto different things. And yeah, but even as adults, we go to work, we're on electronics right now on this podcast, computers, and I go to work, I'm on the screen, and now I'm here, after work, and I'm on the screen here, and just wondering, like, is there, I guess, any kind of rule of thumb, anything we can go by, or is it just the general rule of the least amount of this stuff as possible? And when you're learning, you're reading stuff, try to like read a book instead of reading an electronic device, just doing those little things. Is that kind of like the most important general rule, perhaps?
Yeah, as much as possible would be to get off the devices. Doing things like getting rid of all your notifications, so your attention's not constantly being dragged from one thing to another, is going to really ha improve your relationship with the device, right? That's actually going to make it a lot easier for you to actually just concentrate on one thing rather than flipping backwards and forwards. So, those things are going to help with it. Also, just doing one thing at a time, right? So setting it up so that you've got everything else turned off and you're just concentrating on one thing. So you and I at the moment, we've got everything else turned off so that we don't get distracted. So it's not anywhere near as harmful as if I was, trying to, write an article while I had my email on and it was beeping at me, or and then I had Teams on and it was beeping at me, and I had, something else on that I was also looking at, and so on. So if you just each time you do a task, just focus on the one thing when you're on the device, then that's going to be far less detrimental to your mental health than actually trying to constantly flip. And you're going to be way more productive if you do that. So that's the main one. But we do need to get out and actually socialize. Socializing is actually something that's, again, is really badly affected in us all. But we need to do that more. So, I mean, devices are awesome because we can do this. We're, on different continents and we're able to chat to each other, which is great. But if I want to meet up with someone, if I want to have a meeting with someone here in Sydney, then I will always organize to go and meet them face to face because I know that we're going to connect better when we do that for a whole bunch of reasons. I'm going to get better response from the person. I'm going to understand what they're thinking and what they're doing better. You collaborate a lot better when you're face to face. And so that's really important for us to do as well for a whole bunch of reasons. So, it's good to use the devices when we need to use the devices, but then it's good to go back to what we know actually works and what we know is really good for our brains and our mental health and our physical health when we actually can do that as well.
Thanks for that, Mark. So let control the tools. Don't let the tools control you. Otherwise, you become a tool, I guess you could say. So,
I love that. I'm gonna have to use that one. That's beautiful.
Hey, by all means,
I like
it's all yours now. So, okay, that's
that.
okay. Those are some good insights there. So, I wanted to ask a little bit of stuff about the neuroplasticity. You were talking about that earlier. Like, if you don't use your brain, you lose it, and as we kind of go on in life, they say like I guess as you get older, you want to kind of do different tasks, learn a language, maybe read, some book about a topic that, makes you uncomfortable, that you have an opposing view, just to challenge yourself all the time. That keeps you sharp. And it's so important to do that because then you're going to lose it, right? You lose that brain pattern, thought process, whatever you had before. So, any thoughts on what we should be doing? Probably maybe some of those things. Anything else that you can think of that are good things to, keep our brain health in optimal condition?
Yeah, we do. We need to be careful because, originally Piaget came up with this idea that we had these critical periods that we went through as kids. And once we got past each of those periods, then we were sort of stuck in stone. And once we got to teenagehood, then that was our brain. And basically, it just slowly deteriorated after that. We now know none of that is true. And you can learn a new skill anytime during your life. Anytime during your life, you can lose a skill because you're not actually using it. And so we need to remember that we're constantly changing. Your brain and my brain's going to be different after this podcast than it was before this podcast because of the fact that we actually did this podcast. And so, our brains are constantly changing. But then if you're not using them, then they atrophy. So we need to be using them and using them in different ways and constantly challenging ourselves so that it keeps developing in a positive way rather than atrophying. And that'll decrease the likelihood of you getting neurodegenerative diseases later on, which is really awesome. And as you said, doing things like challenging yourself is really important. And so, reading stuff that you might not normally read, spending time, reading a book is really, really good because it slows you down and enables you to actually think about things. Reading fiction is really awesome because you actually get into the mind of other people when you're reading fiction. Good fiction writer will put you in the mind or in the new world of somebody else, which is really good because you can learn a lot about empathy and emotional intelligence through doing that, and that really activates a lot of those areas of your brain as well. So, reading fiction is great. Reading nonfiction is also good. I've got a book coming out, so yeah, that's an awesome thing to be doing as well. So reading's good, but it's better on a actual paper book than it is on a device. So you actually remember more when you read on paper than you do when you're on a device, and you're less stressed when you read on paper than when you're on a device. So reading things on paper is really, really cool. If you're reading PDFs or whatever, print them out and then read them rather than reading on the devices. If you can do that, and again, it's another way of using device, but only using it in a positive way rather than a negative way. The best thing for you to do is actually to talk to someone. So our brains have actually evolved, and we have large brains to enable us to actually connect with people, to actually talk to each other. And that's why we have such a large brain, because that's a really complicated thing to do. And so actually just sitting down face to face and chatting to someone activates more of your brain than anything else you can do. Number one priority is to keep your brain healthy. Spend lots of time sitting with people and chatting to them, which is a pretty easy thing to do, will actually activate and exercise more of your brain than anything else you can do, and is actually better for us than anything else we can do. So sitting with someone is actually better for our mental health than any drug that's on the market. So there is no drug which is as good for our mental health, for depression, anxiety, and these things, as actually sitting down and chatting to someone. And it'll actually increase your lifespan by up to 15 years just by regularly sitting down with someone you trust and chatting to them. So it's a really awesome thing to do. It actually improves your cardiovascular system. It improves your mental health, but it also improves your overall well-being. So that's, you know, number one, if you want to actually look after your brain and look after your body.
Those are some great tips there, Mark. So I wanted to ask you about, you know, structure in one's life. I'm just kind of curious, you know, for people, like, if they have a routine, a set routine, does that help, I guess, you know, make their brain, you know, stronger in some regard? I mean, it depends what you're putting in the structure. So I'll give you an example. So when I, you know, wake up in the morning now, I kind of do this kind of exercise routine, a little stretching routine. I made a point, do not touch the phone until I'm done this like 20 minute routine. I've been holding firm on this. I've started this like the last month or so, in anticipation of, you know, after of this podcast and learning a bit about you. So then I was like, okay, what about the end of the day? So I make a point of, I've been doing reading like for the last like year or so, at the end of the day, maybe like 15, 20 minutes. And then I would do maybe like 5 to 10 minutes of guided meditation to kind of ease me into the sleep mode. So wonder if you can maybe speak to that, but just some kind, there's just routines in general and maybe some better routines that we should kind of, you know, be aware of and maybe try to adopt.
Yeah, that's a great question. And what you're doing is awesome, especially for your sleep. So sleep is extremely important for us and for our brain, because during sleep, our brain actually sort of gets reset, and these glial cells in our brain actually mop up all of the extra neurotransmitters and any toxins and stuff in our brain. So it gets rid of all those things during sleep. And then we lay down new memories and we do a bunch of other stuff during sleep, which is really important for us. So it's really important to get good sleep, and good sleep hygiene, which is what they talk about, is all about having that routine before you go to bed, but also when you get up in the morning. So always getting up at the same time in the morning will actually help you get to sleep at night, which is, you know, something that most people don't think about. They try and go to sleep at a certain time, but then they don't realize that getting up in the morning at the same time is also really important. So having both ends like that and having routines then that you do when you first wake up is also really important for bringing yourself back to consciousness, because of course you're unconscious when you're asleep, and then you want to do that slowly. And so we want to do that in a positive way and set up our days in a really positive way. So doing something like stretches or exercise or walk the dog or whatever you do is a really positive way to do that. And what you want to do is avoid any stress. And so one of those stresses that we have in our lives, of course, is our devices. And so avoiding those for a little while is actually a really good thing to do. And a lot of people sort of like that, but I like my phone and I like to check, and I get stressed if I don't check my phone, which is actually not true. Checking your phone, just picking up your phone, actually causes stress in all of us. So it's not that you actually like it, it's just that you're trained to like it because you're addicted to it, not because it's actually good for you or that it decreases your stress. It increases your stress. And then there's a huge amount of research showing that. So yeah, lay off the phones for the first 30 minutes and do something else. Go for a walk, have a chat to your partner, have a chat to your kids, whatever it happens to be, but something physical and something which is positive. And again, at night, you've got to relax. You've got to stop thinking, and you got to put the phones away, because the phones also have blue light, which actually activates areas of your brain, which actually decrease the likelihood of you going to sleep. So you don't want to be on devices just before you go to sleep. You want to read things on a piece of paper or do some meditation or something like that, but don't have the device there, and don't call, you know, have that interrupting that transition into sleep. Also, when we actually lay down our memories at night, when we're actually sleeping, we actually do it in reverse order. So if you're actually trying to learn new stuff, or if you've got kids who are trying to learn new stuff, the best thing to do is actually read through it just before you go to sleep, because that's the information that will be laid down in your long-term memory first. So that's also a good tip. But again, do it on paper. Don't do it on a device, but do it on paper. So, you know, write down some notes of stuff you want to remember or whatever, and then read it just before you hit the sack, and it'll actually be laid down first, so you remember it better. So that's also an interesting tip.
Good stuff, Mark. One other thing on the phone thing. I think I was watching one of your other videos where I think it was like some company or some school, they have a phone, like a lock box, so that no one can actually get at it for, I don't know, X amount of hours or what have you. And I think it was something else that you kind of posted somewhere else where like you want to keep your phone before when you go to sleep. Sometimes people they like, put it on their nightstand and you want to keep it as far away as possible. So I wonder if you can speak to that, whatever your research has, told you that like, do we need to keep the phone like in a separate room or like, is there other kind of stuff that we should know about? I guess just not touching is one thing, but keep it far and away, I guess, after that 30-minute window in the morning, maybe whatever it takes, right?
No, you're absolutely right. So we know that if you turn off your phone and put it in your glove box when you're driving, 10% of your attention is still on your phone, even though you've turned it off and you put it in your glove box. And 10% of your attention is pretty much equivalent to having one standard drink. So if you've got your phone in your glove box and turned off, you've pretty much had one standard drink. That's how much attention you've got on the road. If it's actually turned on and it's beside you, then it's far worse, right? And the only way you can get full attention back so you can actually attend to the road is to turn it off and put it in the glove box, sorry, in your boot. So if it's in the boot, then you can't actually get to it. And so therefore your brain then turns off and says, okay, I'm not going to attend to it anymore. But that's the only way to actually remove it from the room completely, or remove it from, your space completely. And we also know if the phone is turned off, but it's beside you, your working memory decreases by a significant amount, and your intelligence decreases by a significant amount. So they've done studies with students where they've had this phone turned off and beside them and turned upside down so they can't actually see the screen. And their working memory and their intelligence is still significantly decreased, which is going to significantly affect their ability to study and their ability to learn. And for us as adults, our ability to be productive and our ability to do, any work that could, requires us to use our brain. So you've got to actually remove the phone from your space. You've got to lock it away somewhere, or put it in another room to actually, therefore, get back your intelligence and get back your working memory, which you can, but you've got to get rid of it to actually do that. So, yeah, the things like, I work with a lot of schools where we put the phone away boxes. We have these see-through boxes, which each student has a key to, and they've got to lock the phone in the box in the morning when they arrive at school. And then when they finish school at night, they can unlock it and take the phone home with them. But during those school hours, the phone's not near them so that they get their full intelligence back, their full intention back, and their full working memory back so that they can actually learn at school, which is what they should be doing, right? Rather than checking their texts and doing the rest of it. And again, when you're at home, have a place where you all put your phones, which is in a general area outside of your bedroom. And that will mean that when you go to your bedroom, you don't have your phone or a device on you. So therefore you're not being distracted by that. Your attention isn't being caught by it, and you can actually concentrate on what you should be doing when you go into your bedroom rather than on your phone and looking at your phone and, getting texts from people and all that sort of stuff. So yeah, we do need to remove it. We need to be feel safe enough. And I think it's like 70% of people are never within arm's length of their phone, 24 hours a day, which is just crazy when you think about it. I mean, this is not a toddler that you've got to actually be monitoring all the time. And I mean, again, it's using it in the wrong way, right? Our phones are awesome because there's a whole bunch of they have a really good memory. And so if people text you or if people email you, all these things, it can actually hold that information for you. You don't have to answer it straight away. You can let it hold it for you for 12 hours or 2 hours or whatever it happens to be. But because of the notifications and because we're being trained by tech companies to constantly look at it, and we automatically look at it every time it beeps at us, we're not using it for what it's actually good at. What it's good at is hold that information so that we don't have to hold it in our own brains. But we should be using it that way, rather than using it the way the tech companies want us to use it, which is to look at it all the time so they can make more money.
Thanks for sharing your thoughts there, Mark. So, interesting factoids there. And you mentioned the, that school program, put away the phone and then kids can't get at it. And like I said, raise their intelligence level. So, something I'm gonna look into here. I'll definitely, enjoy those extra IQ points here and there in the long run. So, for the kids there, I want to kind of ask you a little bit about, talking about like brain development of kids and, over the last, few years, we've had this pandemic and much of this world was locked down and we had to wear masks. As a kid, I can only imagine it was a really confusing time. And again, the formative years, first 5 years or so wearing a mask, the kids aren't able to process, verbal communication, like it's part of learning is seeing how people move their mouths and, just absorbing that in. And if you're wearing your mask all the time, you don't get to absorb that development as it normally would happen. So we had this, pandemic lockdown, I mean, for a couple of 2, 3 years. So would you say that to correct this type of, I guess, deficiency, do we have to make sure we almost like over socialize the kids for 2 to 3 years to, rebalance them to get them back on track? Because I've heard, from people, well, family members, kids, like it's just like some of the kids like in the schools, they're not as, developed as where they should be. I've heard from teachers, kids are behind, right, in their development. Their attention span is really bad, and I think that's been a trend, but it's even more so, it was exacerbated during the pandemic. So how do we go about, correcting this? And it's just means we gotta put that extra effort and emphasis on, socializing kids again so they can get those, quirks and cues from, socializing normally.
Yeah, you're completely right. It was a trend before COVID, so we already saw a decrease in attention span. We already saw a decrease in intelligence. There was an increase in mental health issues amongst the kids. There was a decrease in their ability to recognize facial expressions and all these things because of the amount of time they were spending on devices. Then we had COVID, which meant everyone was locked away, and they weren't. That just exacerbated it. That went skyrocketed in all those areas. Mental health issues went through the roof and all these things because of the fact that people weren't socializing, and socializing is the best thing for our mental health. But also, kids during those formative years need to learn how to socialize, right? You need to learn how to read facial expressions. And we know that kids whose carers use mobile phones a lot actually have abnormal facial expression ability, so actually abnormal ability to recognize facial expression, but also to use facial expression. So there's this new term called the still face effect, where a lot of toddlers and young kids have still faces because they don't know how to use facial expression properly because their carers are using mobile phones and they're not looking at them and not teaching them what the different facial expressions mean by responding to them when they do things, which is really sad. But then they've also got lockdown, so they're not only not getting it from the carers, they're not getting it from anyone, from their friends and all that as well. So it's exacerbated that issue as well. So yeah, we need, and even worse, because our brains are adaptive, a lot of us went into these lockdowns and we were isolated, we were away from everyone. And so our brains adapted to that and started thinking that that was normal, right? It actually adapted and said, oh, this is what I actually like. So now a lot of people have social anxiety because when they go out into the real world, they get very anxious about the fact they're out in the real world because their brains have adapted to that being isolated rather than being out in the real world. But being isolated is really, really bad for us and really bad for both our physical health and our mental health. And it literally kills us. And so we need to get back out. We all of us, including, especially kids, but all of us need to get back out and be spending a lot more time with other people so that our brains will readapt, will change back to the way they should be, which is to actually enjoy that process because there's a huge amount of neurotransmitters that are released when we are socializing, which are really good for us, which we don't get when we're isolated and when we're by ourselves. Even if we're trying to communicate online, it doesn't actually happen. We don't get the same balance of neurotransmitters that we actually need. So we need to get back out, and kids especially need to get back out to learn all of those really crucial abilities. And there was a study done with year 5 kids where they just took bunch of year five, normal year five kids, and they took them on a camp where they didn't have access to any devices, for example. And within 5 days, they had significantly improved their facial expression ability and their empathy towards other kids, right? So their normal facial expression, perception ability, and empathy towards kids is abnormal, right? And that was before COVID. Since COVID, that again has gone through the roof. So we need to start, you know, spending more time with each other, because that's what's most crucial. That's what makes us the alpha species in the world, is our ability to collaborate and our ability to communicate and our ability to work together and thrive. And we're losing that ability, which is a real concern.
Interesting stuff there, Mark. So yeah, it sounds like, yeah, definitely there is a way back, and it might not have to be like 2 to 3 years, as you kind of mentioned there, even just getting like a focused dose of, you know, socialization, just like getting an antibiotic and you get like just a blast of it right away, then you can already see some positive gains there. So that's good. Okay. So I got a different kind of a question for you next here. So longtime scientist that you are, I thought you'd be a great person to ask this broader question about the institution of science that I've been pondering the past few years. So to me, science in its most purest form is you're going to go and have a hypothesis, you're going to do research, you're going to get more data and then compare the data. And then you get to a point where you can make some kind of conclusions and you have a finding, a discovery of some sort. So to me, that's the basics. And then along the way, maybe a different person comes and they do similar research, they do their testing, they get their data, they get the findings, and they come up with a conclusion that may have countered the original, you know, findings and solutions. And I think that's where, you know, a good, robust and respectful debate should occur in the community. And I think that's what's happened, you know, generally speaking, for most of the years I've been on this planet. But in the past few years, I feel that, you know, the institution of science has become very polarizing, and it's a lot of ego, self-interest out there. And in my mind, I don't think anybody has a monopoly on science. Science should be data, facts, discuss them. We can have different views on them, but, you know, we should have a good type of discourse to go hash it out, essentially, right? So having said all of that, just wondering, like, what's your take on like the institution of science? Like, how do we, in some cases, the public has lost trust on the institution of science. Like, is there a way back? How do we get back to that trust with, you know, society? And is it just a matter of just everyone, you know, asking more thoughtful questions and having an open, transparent discussion about, you know, where they're getting their data from, examining that, and just keep that conversation moving forward so we can get to a better place, perhaps?
Yeah, it's a great question. How many hours do you have? We could for several hours, because there's multiple facets to it. So one is the philosophy of science, which is what you were talking about first, which is just that this is the way we do science. You come up with a hypothesis, and then you work out a way of testing that hypothesis, and you want to falsify that hypothesis by doing good experiments, and then you have ways of analyzing that data, which vary greatly, and then you come up with a conclusion based on the results, based on the analysis that you did. And that hasn't changed for a while. That's not the way we always did science, but that's the way we've been doing science for the last 150 years, 200 years, which is still the way we do science. The problem is that on top of that, you've got humans, and it is a human endeavor, science, and humans all come into that endeavor with their with biases. And those biases are because of the fact that we don't perceive the world as it actually is. We perceive the world based on what we call predictive coding. So our brains create this illusion of what we're actually seeing, and that illusion is based on our memory, our long-term memory, which then checks whether or not it is correct. So a good example of that is just speaking. Like when I speak to you, my voice box moves, which creates a wave in the air, and that then, you know, moves your eardrum and moves a couple of bones and moves another little eardrum and moves your cochlea, which then hits little hair cells up against the membrane, which causes activity in your brain. And then your brain creates an illusion that you're hearing sound, you're hearing my voice, but there isn't any noise in the world. There's simply air being vibrated in the world. And so our brain is creating this illusion of the words or of the sound. And all of our senses and the world that we see is based on these illusions that our brain is creating, which we've evolved to enable us to live in the world that we live, which means that we don't have any veridical perception of what's actually out there. So even when, you know, you look at something and you try to take a measurement, you don't have veridical perception of that measurement. It's an assumption based on what you're actually putting into your brain and based on your previous experiences. Yeah. So I might do an experiment and see one thing from the results of that based on my prior experiences, whereas somebody else might do an experiment and see something different based on that, based on their experiences. And so being a human endeavor means that there's always going to be some of that extra in there. We've also got the problem of how do you measure anything and then how do you analyze it? And so there's so many different ways. My area of expertise has always been neuroimaging, you know, taking images of humans' brains while they're doing things using different techniques and then working out how their brains actually work. But there's probably, I don't know, if you look at it, there's probably 100 different ways that you could analyze that data. And each of those ways could probably come up with different results. And you've got to work out what the best way is. And so two different scientists could get exactly the same experiment with exactly the same data and then analyze it differently and come up with different results. So there's lots of aspects to the way we do science that is going to mean that the results are going to come out slightly differently based on our experiences, based on where we're going. But it's also, we have the problem now that in science, it really is a publish or perish sort of phenomenon. So you've got to be constantly publishing to get grants and to keep your job and to keep getting promoted and to keep getting students and all these things. And so you've got to be publishing a ridiculous amount. I remember seeing some stats that I think it was like 30 years ago, most scientists would publish, you know, one paper every 2 years. Now scientists on average are publishing 5 to 6 papers every year. And to actually do that, you know, you've got to be pumping out a huge amount, but it means that you don't have the time to actually check that it's all been done properly and it's all been done really well. And so we've got to somehow change that so that we don't have this really big emphasis on scientists constantly publishing, because the work isn't as good when you're doing that. And then if you think back to like Galileo times and all that, right, they probably publish one paper a year. And so we're trying to pump out too much now, which means that the results often aren't as reliable as they used to be because of that, because we're constantly, and so there's errors being made. But then also, I think the public don't realize that science isn't about coming up with the answer. Science is about getting closer to the answer. So we never actually come up with the truth, right? The only, which I love the quote, I forget who said the quote, but you know, the only science where you can prove anything is mathematics, because mathematics, you can come up with proofs. But every other science, there's no proving anything. All you're doing is trying to get closer to the truth. And so that's where we are. And I think that gets missed a lot in the media, and it gets missed a lot by the public, that we're never actually proving anything. What we're doing is we're getting closer, hopefully getting closer to the truth every time we do an experiment. We're not actually, you know, at the end. So it means that there are going to be lots of times when, yeah, scientific studies are wrong. And we shouldn't be beating up the scientists because of that. And we shouldn't be throwing out all science because of that. We should just realize that we've got to look at, you know, the whole gamut of it and go, what's the trends here? Where are the trends showing us? Which is why, you know, whenever I present stuff on, you know, devices or on the brain or any of these things, I look at both my research but everyone else's research to work out what are most people showing? What are most people, you know, actually in this area? And if 90-95% of people, the scientists, are showing these effects, then I'm like much more confident. Whereas if one scientist shows it, then I'm not that confident. And there's another, so I'm going to come up with another, I told you we could do this for hours. There's another problem is that the high impact journals, the ones that the media actually like to cite from, like Nature and Science and these journals, they only publish stuff which is really unique, which is one-offs, which is way out there. You know, they come up with this new, brand new, wow, look at what we just found. But the problem is they're the least reliable of the results, yet they're the ones that get into the media. And once they're in the media, everyone talks about them and everyone's like, oh, wow, da, 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 da. And so that's what, and then other scientists will come up with a bunch of research showing, no, that's not true. But that'll never get into the media because that'll be published in lower impact journals because these high impact journals don't want to hear about that because it's not new and it's not fancy, right? It's just showing that that wasn't right. So I figure there was a study showing something like 90% of the papers that are published in these high impact journals are actually not replicable. They're not actually true. They're not actually coming up with real results. Yet they're the ones that get all the media attention. And they're the ones that the scientists actually are more likely to get the next grant and are more likely to get a good job because they're publishing those high impact journals, but the results in those high impact journals aren't great. So yeah, there's a few issues for you. I'm not sure how we solve any of this. There are some great people working on some of the solutions to it. Making everything open access and these sorts of things could help. But yeah, I think science is wonderful and science is what got us to where we are today. And science, I think, will keep going into the future. I think we've had a bit of a blip in relation to the way media handle science and the way the public sees science, but hopefully we'll flip back and start realizing that science is cool. I love science.
Great answer there, Mark. So I like that what you talked about, like science is about getting closer to the truth, not like there's a definitive truth. There's always going to be new, you know, I guess adjustments and new learnings over the years, and we should, you know, say maybe science is, you know, getting better one data point at a time, and then we create a better society, perhaps. So more information makes us better. So yeah, good stuff there, Mark. So we've covered a lot of different stuff here, and as we kind of wind down this podcast, you know, I normally ask, I guess, you know, a two-part question for the send-off. So here goes. What are you most grateful for, and what are you most looking forward to in the future?
What am I most grateful for? I'm grateful that I have a wonderful life. I'm extremely fortunate. I live near the beach and I have two beautiful kids who are both healthy and happy and a beautiful partner. And she, you know, is happy with where she is. I think that's what I'm grateful for. I don't have to worry about food. I don't have to worry about, you know, keeping the lights on or any of those things. That's I think what's most important in life. And I have some amazing friends who I get to hang out with on a regular basis. That's definitely what I'd be most grateful for. What was the second one? What am I looking for?
What are you most looking forward to for the future?
I'll bring up my book, because my book actually goes through the fact that I think we're at a real crossroads at the moment. I think we need to make a big decision about which way we want to go as a species. And I'm hoping that there's a shift in the way we're thinking and that we're all going to become more connected rather than less connected. And I mean that real connected, actually spending time with each other. And I hope that's true. My book goes through, you know, where we've come from and where we are at the moment and where I think we should be going, which is in a really positive way. And I hope we don't go the other way, which is where we've been heading for the last few years. So, yeah, that's what I'm hopeful for. I think there's going to be a shift, and I think we're all going to become more connected. We're all going to become more empathic towards each other, and we're going to collaborate more, and we're going to be less busy, and we're going to be more productive, and we're going to get stuff done, and we're going to be able to therefore solve a lot of the issues in society because we're all going to be working together towards solving those problems.
And using,
I think your podcast is working towards that.
Yeah, I hope it is. And hopefully we'll be all using less electronic devices and our phones a little bit less after listening to this podcast. So yeah, no, that's great stuff, Mark. So, you know, we were talking about being connected. How else can people find you and connect with you if they want to know more about you?
Yeah, so you can get the book. The big book is available at all booksellers. I've been told by my publisher, I can't name a particular bookseller, but wherever you buy your books, you should be able to buy The Connected Species. So yeah, at all your booksellers, or you can connect to me on drmarkwilliams.com. So Dr. markwilliams.com. There's lots of links there to both the Connected Teachers Academy and to my book and to Rethinking the Brain and the other things that I'm running and all the courses that I run and a whole bunch of documentaries that I've been on, and I've got a couple of good documentaries coming up, so they'll be put on there as well. So yeah, that'd be the best place, drmarkwilliams.com. Nice and easy.
Excellent. Thanks, Mark. So we'll be sure to add those details to our show notes. So that's a wrap for episode 20. If you like this podcast, please give us a thumbs up or hit the subscribe button below. If you didn't like this podcast, give us a thumbs down, but please do tell us why with a comment below. If you have any other comments, feedback, or suggestions, you know what to do. Thanks for joining us, and namaste, everyone. You.